This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Summer is one of those seasons that always looks perfect from a distance. Long days, vacations, barbecues, that time with family. But if you're anything like me, it can also become a season when you're trying to do everything at once. For me, summer usually means more travel, more projects, more events, and somehow less time to actually slow down. And before I know it, I'm always spending more time managing the season than enjoying it. One thing I've learned over the years, whether I'm working on documentaries, writing books, or producing this podcast, it's that if you don't make time for yourself, no one will do it for you. That's one of the reasons therapy can be so valuable. It can help you better understand your needs, feel more confident setting boundaries, and create a version of summer that actually feels good instead of one you're just trying to survive. I'm proud that BetterHelp continues to support our podcast because it's the world's largest online therapy platform with over 30,000 therapists and more than 6 million people served globally. They match you with a therapist based on a short questionnaire. I've done it. It's no big deal. And if the fit isn't right, you can switch at any time. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/unmarked. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the States in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The most vicious, brutal murders in the history of American crime. These were random murders of strangers. These are people, most of these people were innocent people, literally butchered in the supposed sanctity of their own homes.
For more than 10 years, I've been investigating Charles Manson. I've interviewed Manson himself, I've interviewed members of the family, I've spent years collecting police reports, trial transcripts, autopsy reports, and acquiring recordings that few people have ever heard. I've even contributed to Netflix's new Charles Manson documentary series. And after all of that, I keep coming back to one night, August 8th, 1969.
Don't blame me for your children. You raised your children, you programmed your children, and you made your children.
Everyone knows the name Charles Manson, but Charles Manson never walks into Cielo Drive on the night of the homicides. So who actually controls what is happening inside that house on that night? Who is making the decisions? What does the evidence really tell us about the most infamous murders in American history?
Manson was directing orders like a general, and things were turning very, very quickly.
I've gone back through the original police reports, witness statements, crime scene photographs, hours of interviews with the people who were actually there. And for this episode, we've even rebuilt the interior of Cielo Drive, an exact scale model, so we can reconstruct the murders as they unfolded.
I never knew how to stop it, just like I never knew how to stop Manson all up.
By the end of this episode, you'll know exactly what happened inside Cielo Drive, and why I believe we've misunderstood one of the most important aspects of the Manson case for more than 50 years. I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked.
When everybody is persecuting one person, and they all find it easy because that person doesn't have any backup to help it.
When I first spoke to Charles Manson, I assumed it would be a one-time event. Just another strange story I'd tell about the day Charles Manson actually called me.
Be careful with this phone call, and don't use it to cause any more persecution to my friends, family. Peace, I gotta go. My phone's time's up.
That was more than 10 years ago. 10 years since I became the last journalist to interview Charles Manson, 10 years since I made my first documentary about the case. And since then, I've been chasing this story.
You got to realize that everybody's got their own perspective towards everything. There's only one me. That me lives inside of you. You got to look out for your me first. You're making your documentary film according to your particular...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And you're getting information from people who are doing the same.
Some of my work is now featured in Netflix's new season of Conversations with a Killer, the Charles Manson tapes, in which I even appear. Over the past couple of years, I've been meeting with producers, traveling to Los Angeles, and had the chance to work with director Joe Berlinger and his team. I was interviewed and contributed my own research to the series. And today, I want to use that research to examine one part of the case in particular. The events of August 8, 1969, the homicides that occurred at 10,050 Cielo Drive. A sprawling home at the end of a quiet Beverly Hills cul-de-sac that became one of the most infamous crime scenes in American history. But before we get to that night, let me catch you up. We've already done two episodes on the Manson murders, the first examining the case from Charles Manson's perspective, and the second from the perspective of the women who followed him. No matter whose perspective you choose, the story begins on March 21st, 1967. That's the day Charles Manson, then 32 years old, walks out of Terminal Island Federal Correction Institution after serving a sentence for check fraud. Over the next 2 years, Manson gathers the women and the handful of men who form the commune that becomes known as the Manson Family. And by the end of 1969, 10 of those people, 10 members of the family, including Manson himself, they'll be arrested in connection with a series of 9 murders. So in this episode, we're going to focus on 5 of those murders, all of them occurring on one night, August 8th, 1969.
Don't blame me for your children. You raised your children, you programmed your children, and you made your children.
What you're hearing is an interview Charles Manson gave in 1970 to psychiatrist Dr. Keith Dittman during the retrial proceedings involving Leslie Van Houten. I received this recording through an ongoing FOIA request with the Los Angeles Police Department, along with dozens of other interviews that rarely get heard outside of the case file.
How can I control your mind? Can I control your mind? Can I make a robot out of you?
No.
Can you control mine and make a robot out of me?
No.
If I tell you something that makes sense to you, can you make up your own mind and make a robot out of yourself for a better understanding?
I could.
You see what I'm saying?
What I'm trying to understand from these materials is what actually happened inside Cielo Drive on that night. The Manson murders are often reduced to a single horrifying headline, but when you slow down the evidence, minute by minute, a far more complicated story emerges. That's the story we're going to reconstruct. And to do that, we have to go all the way back, to August 8, 1969, when the family is living at a rundown movie set in California's San Fernando Valley called Spawn Ranch. And now, a word from our sponsors. You may have noticed something. I'm wearing a new jacket, and it's from Quince. As it happens, August is the perfect time to hit the reset button before the autumn rush begins, and honestly, I can't think of a better place to start than my closet. That's why I really enjoyed shopping at Quince. Quince is about fewer, better pieces. Their clothes are made from premium materials built to last and designed to become the ones you reach for day after day. They opened up the store to us, and I chose this jacket, which fits remarkably well. It's 100% cotton. I was really happy with it. Breathable, yet fits nicely, and has this kind of military cut to it. Quality is excellent. It's obviously going to become a staple of my wardrobe. And I gotta say, the price was very reasonable. And that's because everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories, and they cut out the middleman, so you're paying for high quality, not brand markup. And it's not just the clothing. Quince has become my go-to for everything from hotel-quality bedding and bath essentials to premium cookware and travel must-haves, which is a big thing for me. So upgrade your everyday. Go to quince.com/unmarked for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's Quince, quince.com/unmarked for free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/unmarked. And if you like this jacket right now, it is available on quince.com, and we will put a link to it in the show notes. And now, back to the record. The summer of 1969 is often remembered as the end of the 60s. But on August 8th, nobody knows that yet. The summer of love is fading, Woodstock is still a week away, and Neil Armstrong has walked on the moon less than 3 weeks earlier. Hollywood feels prosperous, even safe, and that might be for the last time. On August 8th, four members of the Manson family are preparing to leave Spahn Ranch. Now, the sheer amount of people associated with the Manson family can be overwhelming. Followers came and went, aliases changed, and over the years, the cast of characters grew larger. So by August 8th, we're talking about 20 people or so living with the group. But the events at Cielo Drive, they only revolve around four of these people. Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, Tex Watson, and Linda Kasabian. Each arrives at the ranch by a different path. Each has a different relationship with Charles Manson, and each will play a different role before the night is over.
Susan Atkins, she was definitely a sociopath, but I think of all of them, I would describe her as the most under Manson's influence.
This is an interview I conducted with former Manson family prosecutor Stephen Kay back in 2015, excerpts of which I'll play throughout this episode.
One time, Manson told her to go get him a coconut down in Brazil, and she went out the front door like she was going to go down to Brazil to get him a coconut.
Susan Atkins grows up in Santa Clara, north of Los Angeles. When she's 14, her mother dies of cancer and it leaves the family devastated. Her father descends into alcoholism and Susan is essentially abandoned. She begins hitchhiking wherever she can find a ride. She's arrested for Grand Theft Auto before drifting into San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district, where she's introduced to marijuana and LSD. This is Atkins speaking from prison after her incarceration.
I used to think that you came down off an acid trip after 12 hours. That's not true. Every time you take LSD, the moral fiber of your character, which is in, put in you, or when you grow up, everybody grows up with different morals according to their culture. Okay, when you take acid, your mind expands beyond these moral characteristics and your concepts of right and wrong.
This becomes the lens through which Atkins explains her actions after her arrest.
And every time you drop acid, you get a little bit further away from reality. And I took so much acid that I just was what I would term spaced. And it took me many years to what I term now re-enter.
Atkins later describes meeting Charles Manson in a flop house in San Francisco before spending the next 18 months undergoing what she later calls a process of, quote, deprogramming.
Yes, to realize that by my own free will, I willingly got into something that completely took control over me, that I lost control of myself. Behind drugs and a process of deprogramming, losing my morals.
In other words, Atkins argues that Manson's antisocial worldview combined with heavy hallucinogens explains her state of mind on the night of August 8th. And this mindset, it also applies to Atkins' co-conspirator, the second of the party who leaves Spahn Ranch on August 8th, Patricia Krenwinkel. At that time, she's known simply as Katie. This is Krenwinkel at a 1993 parole hearing.
Prior to Mr. Manson, I used primarily alcohol and marijuana, and then LSD, which basically just came out in 1965, I think 1966. It was the first time I'd used it, about twice before I had met him. But that was really one of his choices of drugs that we used.
Krenwinkel grows up in Southern California in a family that slowly comes apart. Her older half-sister struggles with drug addiction, her parents divorce, and Patricia spends her teenage years moving from one high school to the next. She follows her sister with drugs and alcohol, beginning with marijuana, before becoming dependent on benzedrine, initially prescribed by a family doctor for weight loss. When Krenwinkel is 19, her family fractures even further. Her mother moves to Alabama, leaving Patricia and her sister alone in Los Angeles. That's when Krenwinkel's sister introduces her to a recently released ex-convict named Billy. And it's Billy who in turn introduces her to another convict, Charles Manson.
When I met Mr. Manson, basically I fell in love with a man. I met him and it was he and I thought I was falling in love with a man. Eventually he started defining himself as a god. And once becoming a god, then there is not a male-female relationship as would be considered.
That progression is psychologically revealing. Krenwinkel doesn't describe waking up one day brainwashed. She describes a gradual shift in the way she sees the world due to prolonged use of hallucinogens. But of course, we always have to ask, is that what really happened? Listen to this excerpt from Charles Manson, recorded around the same time in the early 1970s, in which he rejects this explanation.
We were not all that much into drugs. Everybody say we were, but that's not the truth. The truth was we took acid whenever it was around. I never went out of my way to get it. Sometimes it'd be maybe once a week, sometimes once a month, sometimes three times a month.
Over the years, I've spoken with several people connected to this case, and one theme comes up again and again. By the summer of 1969, Krenwinkel and Atkins don't see themselves as individual decision makers. Instead, they identify as something more akin to soldiers carrying out a mission. Their goal is to defend the Manson family against any perceived outside threats.
There was a lot of conflict going in the music and a lot of conflict going on in the social consciousness and a lot of conflict going on, period. Whoops. The young girls somehow have tendency to reflect that conflict.
And this is echoed in the third member of the party departing Spahn Ranch on August 8th, Charles Watson, known to everyone in the group as Tex. By every account, Tex is the all-American kid, an excellent student, standout athlete, later fraternity member at North Texas State. But somewhere along the way, that life stops being enough. This is Tex from a 1984 parole hearing in which he explains his motivations.
And I was seeking something that apparently I had not found for satisfaction, for happiness, for contentment. And I had not found it anywhere, so in my search, I began to take drugs and hallucinogenics, heavy on the alcohol, and more or less dropped out of society.
Tex later offers different explanations for why he leaves Texas. In one account, he says California simply captivated him. And in a 1971 psychiatric report that I found among his defense records, he says something entirely different. He says that he wanted to escape his controlling mother after years of conflict. Either way, Tex spends roughly a year with Manson prior to August 8th, 1969, and during that time, he describes a process of perceived indoctrination.
My parents no longer existed in my thinking. I became very susceptible to the family and the teachings of Mr. Manson, and gave myself completely to him.
Across these interviews, I'm seeing a pattern. Atkins talks about drugs and deprogramming. Krenwinkel describes Manson evolving from a romantic partner into a godlike figure. And Tex, he talks about abandoning his family, his own judgment, and eventually his sense of self.
Just becoming susceptible to his teaching, to a point to where I would do anything without care for myself, my own personal safety, my own life.
One of the earliest psychologists to study what was then called brainwashing was Edgar Schein, a professor at MIT. After the Korean War, Schein examined why some prisoners appeared to cooperate with their captors while others didn't. His conclusion wasn't that people could have their free will erased. Instead, he argued that profound changes in belief and identity occur under a very specific set of conditions. Four conditions, as a matter of fact. Number one, isolation from previous relationships. Number two, dependence on a new social group. Number three is uncertainty about the future. And finally, repeated reinforcement of a new worldview. A variation of this theory is often called coercive control, but Schein called this coercive persuasion. The important thing to remember is that with people in this context, their beliefs may change dramatically, but their capacity to make choices doesn't disappear. And that explains why Watson, Atkins, and Krenwinkel are increasingly willing to commit violence. But it doesn't explain away the choices they make when they leave Spahn Ranch. And that brings me to the last of the four people leaving Spahn Ranch on that night, Linda Kasabian. She is distinct from the other three because she has a completely different motivation. Unlike Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Watson, Kasabian has only been at the ranch for a matter of weeks. At the time, she's a 20-year-old mother with no history of violence, and by her own account, she barely knows Charles Manson. Just a few months earlier, she's living in New Hampshire with her husband and young daughter. She follows her husband to California, but the relationship collapses almost immediately. With nowhere else to go, a woman she meets brings Linda to Spahn Ranch. And within 24 hours, Linda has met Tex Watson, stolen approximately $5,000 from her estranged husband, and returned to the ranch to meet Charles Manson for the first time. 3 weeks later, she's sitting in the car on the night of August 8th. So unlike the other three who credit their decisions on August 8th to Manson's influence, it appears most likely that Kasabian is chosen to accompany them by Tex. This suggests that once the mission begins, Tex is exercising far more authority than he's often given credit for.
There's no question. I was the leader of the killings on the scene of the crime. There's no question. The point that I'm trying to make that even though I was the leader at the time, I was also very much a follower.
Sundown on August 8th, 1969 is 8:37 p.m. At this time, four of the night's victims are having dinner at El Coyote Cafe, about a 40-minute drive from Spahn Ranch. The final victim is still at work closing up shop at Jonas Miller Stereo. At Spahn Ranch, multiple witnesses see Manson talking to Tex Watson. What's said between them remains unclear even decades later, but according to Watson's biography, he claims that Manson says, and I quote, "What I want you to go to that house where Melcher used to live. I want you to take a couple of the girls I'll send with you and go down there and totally destroy everyone in that house. As gruesome as you can, make it a real nice murder, just as bad as you've ever seen, and get all their money." End quote. Now, Watson's account of August 8th has drifted over time, and this is a departure from Watson's own trial testimony, and almost all researchers agree that whatever Manson said, it was not as explicit as this excerpt claims. but it does give us a window into Watson's thinking at the time.
As far as me taking the lead role, I was the male at the crime. But at that time, I did not consider myself a leader. I considered myself more of a follower of Charles Manson in carrying out his orders. Even though I have leadership qualities at this time, at that particular time, when I was 23 years old, and I don't feel I had the leadership qualities to carry that out. So there's some questions to what leadership capacity that I had at that time.
The problem is this. If Tex Watson is merely carrying out Charles Manson's will, why do we repeatedly find him making independent decisions on the night of August 8th? This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Summer is one of those seasons that always looks perfect from a distance. Long days, vacations, barbecues, that time with family. But if you're anything like me, it can also become a season when you're trying to do everything at once. For me, summer usually means more travel, more projects, more events, and somehow less time to actually slow down. And before I know it, I'm always spending more time managing the season than enjoying it. One thing I've learned over the years, whether I'm working on documentaries, writing books, or producing this podcast, it's that if you don't make time for yourself, no one will do it for you. That's one of the reasons therapy can be so valuable. It can help you better understand your needs, feel more confident setting boundaries, and create a version of summer that actually feels good instead of one you're just trying to survive. I'm proud that BetterHelp continues to support our podcast because it's the world's largest online therapy platform with over 30,000 therapists and more than 6 million people served globally. They match you with a therapist based on a short questionnaire. I've done it. It's no big deal. And if the fit isn't right, you can switch at any time. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/unmarked. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is former Manson family prosecutor Stephen Kay.
What Manson said to Adkins and Krenwinkel, go with Tex and do what Tex tells you to do. We didn't have any evidence that that specific night that Manson said, go out and start Helter Skelter, he just said, go with Tex and do what Tex tells you to do.
This again is Susan Adkins.
I don't think Charles Manson's mind was in control of Tex's mind that night. I think that it was a higher power than that. Charlie's human too, you know, and his mental powers are just as limited, maybe not as limited as other humans, but that there was an evil force in control of Tex that night.
For Manson's part, he spends years rejecting the suggestion that he somehow controlled the minds of the people around him.
How can I control your mind? Can I control your mind? Can I make a robot out of you?
No.
Can you control mine and make a robot out of me?
No.
If I tell you something that makes sense to you, can you make up your own mind and make a robot out of yourself for a better understanding?
I could.
You see what I'm saying?
And here's another detail that often gets omitted in Tex Watson's recollections. Listen to this interview with Susan Adkins, in which she describes her and Watson taking stimulants before leaving the ranch on August 8th.
Tex and I had our own special little stash of cocaine. Yeah, I think it was cocaine or methadone, I'm not sure which. And we were speeding. We both snorted some speed and got in the car. We were very, very wired.
Remember, on August 8th, 1969, once the group leaves Spahn Ranch, they have no further contact with Manson. He isn't in the car. Tex Watson is. Charles Manson may have set this mission in motion, but the evidence increasingly suggests that the violence itself unfolds through Tex Watson's choices. And based on the evidence I've seen, It's Tex who chooses the destination.
While you were a follower of Mr. Manson's, you were the leader of the party that went to the...
Yes, that's correct.
Residence.
We know that the group arrives at Cielo Drive around midnight. This is Prosecutor Stephen Kay describing what happens next.
Watson tells Linda Kasabian to drive around the corner because he doesn't want anybody to see the car. And then she comes back and she sees Watson climb up the telephone pole. Now, Watson had tennis shoes on, and the first run was 15 feet off the ground. Plus, he was carrying a pair of 30-pound bolt cutters. And so when he got to the top, he cut the phone wires because he didn't want anybody calling out.
10,050 Cielo Drive is a sprawling lot that sits on a hilltop. Cielo Drive itself is a short, winding road, and at the bottom stands a daunting metal gate. After midnight, the group leaves the car and walks towards the main gate.
There was a dirt hillside next to the gate, and the fence was covered with barbed wire and everything, so he put the rope on top of the barbed wire, and the girls climbed over, and then he climbed over and got the rope.
During her grand jury testimony, Atkins said, quote, "I held the knife between my teeth and climbed over and got my pants caught on part of the fence and had to kind of boost myself up and lift from where I was caught off the fence and fell into the bushes on the other side of the fence." In other words, Atkins recalls struggling to climb over the fence, taking her away from the group. At the same time, Watson leads Linda Kasabian and Patricia Krenwinkel up the long driveway towards the main house. Now, according to Krenwinkel, it's at this point that Tex divulges their intent to commit a home invasion and possibly multiple homicides.
"I wasn't sure what we were going to do until he said what we were going to do. I had no idea. Because at that point in time, like I said, we had been going and doing robberies, basically. We had been stealing things. I had no idea that that's what the intention was at all."
If Krenwinkel's recollection is accurate, it means the four people who left Spahn Ranch were not operating from a shared understanding of the mission. This is in contradiction to the prosecution's narrative and difficult to reconcile with the popular image of Charles Manson as the puppet master controlling every movement from miles away. Once they leave Spahn Ranch, Tex Watson becomes the person directing what happens. And this becomes obvious when they're met by their first victim, Stephen Parent. At this time, Stephen Parent is a California native. The oldest of five children, he grows up in El Monte, east of Los Angeles. His family is working class, and by the summer of 1969, he's working two jobs to save money to attend community college that fall. But on the evening of August 8th, shortly after 11 p.m., Stephen finishes his shift at Jonas Miller Stereo and drives across Los Angeles towards the guest house at the far end of Cielo Drive. He's there to sell an AM/FM Sony Digimatic radio to the property's caretaker, Bill Gerritsen. At trial, Gerritsen later estimates that Stephen Parent leaves the guest house at approximately 12:15 a.m. and drives away. This means that the headlights of his white 1965 Rambler Ambassador illuminate three members of the Manson family inside the main gate at approximately 12:20 a.m.
Watson pointed the gun at him, and Parent begged for his life. He said, "Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. I won't say anything. I'm on my way out. I won't tell anybody." And Watson then proceeded to shoot him four times in the upper torso at point-blank range.
According to Linda, it's then that she reaches through the driver's side window, switches off the engine, turns off the headlights, and leaves the key in the ignition. The interior of Cielo Drive is the key to understanding the murders. The crime scene photographs show the aftermath, but they don't convey the space itself. So for our first documentary, we built a full-scale replica of the interior using the original crime scene photographs, police diagrams, and real measurements.
Watson was at a dining room window, and he was cutting the screen horizontally, and then took the screen off, and then climbed in through the open window, and then went around and opened the front door.
That's how the Manson family gain entry. The living room itself is distinct. At its center is a low coffee table resting on a thick carpet. Opposite sits a cushioned sofa with a blanket patterned like the American flag draped over the back. There are unopened steamer trunks in the entryway, which had been delivered hours earlier, containing clothing from the homeowner's recent trip. And beyond the living room, a hallway leads deeper into the house towards the bedrooms. Now remember, the Manson family has no idea who's inside the house. They aren't even certain who lives in the house. They've never even met the couple renting the property at this moment, Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. And when they enter, they encounter a person asleep on the couch. His name is Wojciech Frykowski, a Polish writer and close friend of Roman Polanski. Frykowski is staying at Cielo Drive with his girlfriend, Abigail Folger, while Polanski is in Europe filming. They've been keeping Sharon Tate company during the final weeks of her pregnancy. Within seconds of the Manson family entering the living room, Frykowski is awakened by the sound of intruders moving through the house. This again is Susan Atkins describing what happens.
One of the people said, "Who are you?" in Texan. "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." And I remember that in my conscience, it's so alive in me. I'm just recalling it. I remember that I had gone so far and there was no turning back. Even if I had wanted to run, even if I had wanted to leave, I couldn't. It was like I was caught in something that I had no control over.
At Tex Watson's direction, the women begin to clear the bedrooms. They bring everyone inside the house into the living room. At this point, beside Frykowski on the couch is his girlfriend, Abigail Gibby Folger. She's 25 years old, the youngest of 10 children, and the daughter of Peter Folger, the president of the Folger Coffee Company. A Harvard graduate and art historian, she'd returned to California the year before after meeting Frykowski in New York. The Manson family uses towels and pillowcases that they find inside the house to bind and blindfold the captives. At this point, the final two occupants are brought into the living room, Jay Sebring and Sharon Tate. And make no mistake, Sharon Tate is the reason Charles Manson becomes infamous. Her murder captures international attention, placing enormous pressure on the LAPD to solve the case. At just 26 years old, Tate is on the verge of becoming one of Hollywood's brightest young stars. Standing beside her is Jay Sebring, a Detroit native who trained as a barber in the Navy. After he moved to Los Angeles, he built one of Hollywood's first celebrity hairstyling empires. But no one in the family knows any of this. They've never seen Jay Sebring before this night. And with everyone now assembled in the living room, the Manson family begins to improvise. The rope they brought to restrain their victims is never used as originally intended. Instead, Tex loops it around Sharon Tate's neck, throws it over an exposed ceiling beam, and ties the other end around Jay Sebring's neck.
The people in the house were all brought into the living room and tied up, and I remember that Wojciech Frykowski, I believe is his name, I had tied his hands with a towel and then was instructed to kill him. He saw that I couldn't move, and he very easily undid the ties, the towel that I had tied his wrist with, and he and I began to fight. And I remember I was screaming for help, and he was screaming for help.
It's approximately 12:45 a.m. This is the moment the murders truly begin. A nearby resident will later tell detectives she hears a single scream at this time, followed by several voices. The sound was brief, and in Benedict Canyon, late night parties are common, so nothing about the noise seems unusual enough to call police. Inside the house, Tex orders Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring onto their stomachs, still bound together by the rope. Sebring refuses to stay quiet. He pleads with Tex to let Sharon sit up, reminding him that she's nearly 9 months pregnant. Even in that moment, Sebring continues challenging the man holding the gun. This again is Patricia Krenwinkel.
How about Sebring? He started to...
He fought with Tex.
And then he ended up being shot at that time.
This again is Tex Watson.
When I went into the estate, I did stab Jay Sebring after he was shot by myself.
I'm looking at Jay Sebring's official coroner's report issued on August 10th, 1969 by the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner at the Hall of Justice in Los Angeles. I've spent a lot of time with these records. They're clinical and detached. Sebring's report documents a single gunshot wound to the left side of the chest, approximately 15 and a half inches below the top of his head. It also records 6 stab wounds. The fatal injury is described as a 1.5-inch wound to the chest that severed a major artery, resulting in fatal blood loss.
I can remember seeing people just scattering in different places and running in different places, and I was left sitting with Sharon Tate.
At this time, Sharon Tate is still tied to Jay Sebring. That's when Wojciech Frykowski suddenly springs from the couch and lunges towards the front door of the house, where Susan Atkins tackles him, forcing Tex to intervene.
Frykowski's blood was on the porch because he had run out the front door and he had been stabbed by Atkins in the legs, so he was bleeding from the legs, and then he got out to the front lawn and Watson jumped on him and proceeded to stab him over and over again and hit him over and over with the butt of the gun. Frykowski was hit 13 times with the butt of the gun on his head, and his head was kind of misshapen from all the damage, and he was stabbed 51 times.
At almost the same moment, Abigail Folger breaks free and runs down the hallway towards the master bedroom. The crime scene photographs show a trail leading in that direction, marking her desperate attempt to escape. She reaches the glass doors overlooking the swimming pool and is caught by Krenwinkel. This is an excerpt from Krenwinkel's 1993 parole hearing, in which she's questioned as to what happens next.
One victim, Folger, ran out of the back door and she was pursued by you, is that correct?
Yes, it's true.
And you stabbed her several times?
Yes, I did.
Has she made it out to the yard itself?
Yes, she did.
And what was she doing?
She was running, she was fleeing.
What happened when you caught up to her?
I stabbed her.
In the back?
Yes, she turned around.
Did she fall immediately?
Yes.
Okay, how many times did you stab her?
I have no idea.
More than one time?
Yes.
And then at some point in time, I would assume that she was immobilized. Did she fell down? Was she moving?
Yes.
Okay, and was she talking to you or groaning or what was she doing?
She's saying stop.
Okay, and you continued to stab her?
Yes, and then I left and went and got Tex.
Abigail Folger ended up getting stabbed 28 times, and Watson inflicted some of those stab wounds, because when he was finished with Frykowski, he went over and inflicted some stab wounds.
That brings us to the Manson family's final victim from August 8th, Sharon Tate. I'm looking at the official Los Angeles County homicide report into her death. According to Patricia Krenwinkel, she is not present for Sharon Tate's final moments. Krenwinkel says that after Abigail Folger is killed, she remains outside in the yard and doesn't return to the house until after Tate has already been murdered.
Sharon was the last. Sharon was begging for her life. She was being held by Susan Atkins, and she said, "Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me. I just want to have my baby. Please let me have my baby." And Susan Atkins looked her in the eye, and pardon my English, but quoting Susan Atkins, she said, "Look, bitch, I don't care about you or your child. You're going to die, and you better be ready for it, and I don't feel a thing behind it."
The autopsy paints a picture of a desperate struggle. It documents 16 stab wounds, along with 2 defensive wounds to Sharon's forearms. The autopsy tells investigators that Sharon was conscious, aware of what was happening, and trying to defend herself. And when the violence ends, the family turns its attention to something else.
Tex was telling Susan to write something.
And you're aware?
I don't really know, because he was just telling me to write something.
Write something?
Yes.
Did you know what he meant by that?
To put something on the walls, yes.
Somebody wrote on the wall, and using one of the victim's blood, the term pig, or the word pig. Is that correct?
Yes.
For years, this moment has been portrayed as further evidence of Charles Manson's control over the crime. But notice who's giving instruction. According to Krenwinkel, it isn't Charles Manson. He's miles away at Spahn Ranch. It's Tex Watson directing Susan Atkins to write on the wall. I want you to listen to this excerpt from Patricia Krenwinkel because I think it captures the way these 4 individuals have explained their actions over the years.
When all the madness took place, I had absolutely no... There was no way to put together the kind of rational thinking, because there was no rational thought in my head. I had followed the instructions as I had been told to do, as I'd been doing for a very long time. And I, at that point, everything was out of my control. I felt helpless. I felt hopeless to do anything. All I was doing is carrying through a macabre dance. It was horrible, and I didn't know how to stop it. And I never knew how to stop it. Just like I never knew how to stop Manson all along.
Since 1969, each of the participants has offered a variation of this same explanation. Susan Atkins blames drugs. Patricia Krenwinkel describes surrendering her identity. Tex Watson says he simply gave himself completely to Charles Manson. And Linda Kasabian maintained that she was too frightened to intervene. Now, juries were never persuaded by any of these arguments. First of all, Linda Kasabian never faced a jury because she was granted immunity in exchange for her testimony. She spent the rest of her life living largely out of the public eye, dying in 2023. And Charles Manson, despite never setting foot inside Cielo Drive on that night, was convicted of all 5 murders, as well as 4 additional murders and 1 count of conspiracy. He spent the rest of his life in prison before dying in 2017. Tex Watson was convicted of 8 murders and conspiracy. He remains incarcerated at the Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility after more than 5 decades in prison. Susan Atkins was also convicted of 8 murders. She died behind bars in 2009 after California denied her request for compassionate release. Patricia Krenwinkel was convicted of 7 murders and remains incarcerated today at the California Institution for Women. At 78 years old, she's currently the state's longest-serving female prisoner. Yet more than half a century later, the murders at Cielo Drive are still described as the work of Charles Manson. And in one sense, that is completely true. Without Manson, none of these 4 people would likely have walked up that driveway. But after spending years reading the police reports, comparing witness statements, interviewing participants, and reconstructing the crime scene, I think the evidence points to something more nuanced.
"Don't blame me for your children. The judge that sits on that bench is responsible. And if he hasn't got the mind to be responsible, and he hasn't got the thought to be responsible, then wake up to where your man is and where your judge is.
Charles Manson cultivated the environment that made the violence possible. But once those four people left Spahn Ranch, the decisions increasingly became their own. Tex Watson decided when to reveal the mission. He decided how the attack would unfold. He directed the others once inside the house. He told Susan Atkins to write on the wall. Those are all choices. And the women too, they made choices, terrible ones. Recognizing that does not diminish Charles Manson's culpability. It reminds us that influence, even profound influence, is not the same as control. Perhaps that's the most unsettling lesson of Cielo Drive. The people who walked into that house, they weren't puppets. They were human beings. Human beings that chose to carry out one of the most terrible nights in American history. Before we wrap, a few show notes. If you want to go deeper into the Manson case, and I highly suggest everybody does, you should pick up my book, Charles Manson, The Last Words, on Amazon, Kindle, and Kindle Unlimited. This book is 10 years of research and work, including my recorded conversations with Charles Manson during his final year of life. And if you haven't already, you can check out the additional Manson content that we've put out. Episodes are available on our YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can see me right now in Netflix's Conversations with a Killer, the Charles Manson tapes. This episode of Unmarked was produced by John Nadeau. Our editor is Dave Alderson, and our additional producer is Jesse Demaray. Until next week, this is Unmarked.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.